I posted on a few therapist Facebook pages asking to learn more about the lived experiences of those with chronic pain. I asked these therapists to answer two broad questions. What are the biggest misconceptions you faced in relation to your pain? And what do you think other therapists need to know? I got a lot of responses, around a dozen, and there were a few themes that came up over and over again. One was around the unpredictability of chronic pain. It creates logistical challenges in everyday life, like what if it flares up right before a session? Should they cancel? At what point? It feels like a lose-lose. And its impacts are holistic, not just the pain itself, but the anxiety surrounding it, the financial ramifications. The list goes on and on. Another topic that came up a lot, although it was harder to condense down into a single theme, was around narcotic pain medication. Some mentioned they weren't taking it, but others just assumed they were. Some mentioned not being able to get access, even in times of desperate need. And then, of course, there were more personal experiences. Someone who indicated the toll her pain took on her spiritual identity, especially earlier in life. Another mentioned the toll on their trust in the medical system altogether. I think the multi-layered impact of chronic pain is one of the reasons it can be intimidating as a clinician. Like, where do we start? What works? I'm Tobin Richardson, a counselor educator with a vision to save the therapist by creating a forever free podcast style platform designed for learning. And here, digging into that very question, what works? What do we know about chronic pain? Learning through a therapist who's asked herself that question over and over again, and is constantly engaging with the literature, and then applying what she learns in her own clinical practice, monitoring its effect. Dr. Lindsay Cirincione is a psychologist who specializes in working with teens and young adults who are suffering with chronic pain. And I just have to say up front that one of the things she talked about in our conversation that I continued to think about afterwards was that she acknowledged that she doesn't have all the answers. Nobody does. Which I guess is both obvious and yet still really refreshing to hear, especially coming from someone like her who's so engaged in scholarly work. Because I don't think we talk about it enough, that we're still learning a lot all the time about how we as humans work. But of course, her extensive experience has taught her a lot about what are the best practices as we know them today, and then what doesn't work, or sometimes what actually makes things worse, which is a real thing that can happen in chronic pain work, even among the very best intentioned therapists. And you'll hear about all that here.
If I'm completely honest, when I started my journey into sort of the medical setting as a psychologist, chronic pain was actually something I didn't think I wanted to work with because it can be super intimidating and complex and hard to navigate for therapists. And so I actually kind of fell into chronic pain by just sort of seeing patients, like most of us do, right? Seeing patients who happened to also have a chronic pain disorder. And then, you know, I come from an academic medical setting, sort of embedded in hospitals and subspecialty clinics. So I was able to get more formal training in the chronic pain space. And it kind of just naturally occurred as I had folks coming to me struggling with these problems out of a desire to just help them feel better, or at the very least, be informed enough to not make anything worse. I encourage folks, like, there are some good websites out there, there's some good literature out there, and really understanding the difference between acute pain, which would largely be kind of an immediate medical response, and chronic pain, which crosses over from a medical response only to oftentimes a medical intervention crossed with teaching folks how to live with chronic pain in a way that promotes the best quality of life possible. And it can be intimidating because as therapists, we can't fix a pain disorder. We're not qualified for that, but we can have a very unique role in supporting people in improving their lives when chronic pain is part of the picture.
Imagine the vast majority of your caseload presenting with chronic pain. They also have some ongoing relationship with a physician or a medical, another medical provider. Do you find that it's necessary that you work really closely in collaboration, or do you feel like they're two pretty different goals?
Is it absolutely necessary for a therapist to have a close relationship with the treating physician in order to be successful? No. There is a vast difference in a success rate when a therapist has access to quality collaboration with a medical provider and when they don't. So, to the extent that it is humanly possible, yes, it's necessary. Because we come at things from our own specialties, right? And we will see and understand things that the physicians are not seeing in their medical appointments. And the physicians are able to sort of include us in conversations about, well, this is our next step for treatment, and this really is what we're recommending for this patient in terms of how often they can exercise or how they're supposed to be managing their medications. And that puts us as therapists in a position to sort of support a common goal as opposed to working on two different spaces. All of the literature out there suggests that the best treatment for chronic pain involves both medical and psychological care happening together in a multidisciplinary setting. So even if you're not embedded in a medical setting, even if you don't have personal relationships with physicians, collaborating with those physicians is going to give your clients or your patients the best outcome.
Yeah. And what does that collaboration look like? I'm thinking for a private practitioner, like, are you thinking like sharing like notes, ongoing consultation calls?
Yeah. So it can look a lot of different ways for folks in private practice. The way that I usually start is I include in sort of my services through my private practice, kind of the expectation that obviously with client permission, I will be contacting your medical providers, because that's going to give us the best outcome is if we're contacting one another. And then, you know, every physician has their own way of managing these things. Every physician has their own degree of openness to collaboration with mental health providers. And so what I usually do is I ask for an email address. If the client has an email address for their physician, that's usually the best way to go about getting a response. If not, I'll just call the office and say, I have a mutual patient, I'm calling to consult. Can we set up a time to meet? I do really recommend a very brief meeting initially. It doesn't have to be an ongoing sort of face-to-face meeting, but having that first kind of interaction be real time can be very helpful in communicating, like, what are the roadblocks that the physician is facing with the patient? What are the concerns that the patient is bringing to therapy? And having that open conversation in real time to begin with. And then email updates can really suffice after that, unless something big changes about the picture.
That makes a lot of sense. Yeah, because I don't want to go too into the weeds on this, but that it is kind of a thought that pops in my head is like, this sounds like an added layer of administrative burden, which is usually not what therapists are looking for. So that sounds like you have kind of found this really practical way to do this as efficiently as possible. Mm-hmm. It is totally worth it as far as the impact on client care.
100%. I have not done any research on this, but I would say kind of anecdotally, you are going to be far more productive in your work with the patient or your client if you are collaborating with that physician, such that you probably won't need to see them for as many sessions. So when you think about like use of time, you're moving by collaborating with a physician, you're sort of moving your treatment outcomes to a faster pace by being able to share that information. The way that we treat problems with the body in America is by treating the body. And it's very, very common for folks oftentimes even to be referred to me and show up and say, I have a medical problem. I don't even know why I'm here. Like, why am I talking to a psychologist about my medical problem? So I think in that way, therapists kind of educating themselves even just about things like, you know, key terms to sort of look for would be things like the mind-body connect, and being able to adequately explain to folks, yes, you have a medical problem and you are getting medical treatment, and this treatment, what we're doing is really helping to sort of ease the burden of your pain and ease the burden of your medical care. And the research tells us it gives you a better chance of achieving remission if we do these things. They may not seem directly connected at first, but if a therapist can sort of very compassionately explain why it makes sense to also utilize some behavioral pain management strategies in addition to the medical care, generally folks are very understanding of that and they kind of get on board really quickly. But there is almost always this initial tension of the need to really nail that first explanation as to why psychology or therapy is an important component of chronic pain management. We also have to keep in mind that nearly all people with chronic pain, particularly women and particularly people of color, have been repeatedly dismissed by medical providers over and over again in their search for support. And so many times when those same people hear from their medical providers, you need to see a psychologist, it can often sound like another dismissal. And so it's on us as therapists to understand that that may be where our clients are coming in, and to be able to say like, hey, I believe you. I don't think that this is all in your head. I am here to support your medical journey. I am here to help you develop skills for managing your pain in ways that medicine doesn't teach. Most of the time, people really sort of open up to that if it's done compassionately.
How long does it take before you can kind of like get their buy-in? Can you do that in a session or two?
With a lot of practice, yes. And I think it's, you know, it is similar, if I could equate it to anything, and I don't want to even use the word equate, but if I could sort of parallel it to anything, those of us who are trauma trained, who do trauma work, it's similar to the journey of meeting a new person and getting them comfortable enough to start disclosing bits and pieces of what happened, right? It's really that making sure that they understand, I'm on your team here. I believe you. I am here to support you. I am not here to tear you down. I am here in this journey with you. And any therapist who has that skill set can certainly get there with patients who have chronic pain.
Yeah. I love that. What else? So what are the other, I guess, like misconceptions, or what are the things a therapist needs to understand if they're working with someone who's facing chronic pain, maybe for the first time in their career?
Yeah. That's a really good question. And to put it very bluntly, I think that therapists need to understand that there are many things they can do to make it worse without knowing. Right? None of us set out in this profession to make people feel worse. But when it comes to the world of chronic pain, there is so much information out there in the lay world and even in sort of therapeutic spaces that haven't necessarily kind of been inundated with research and training in the evidence base around chronic pain. And let's be real, most of our graduate programs don't really talk about chronic pain as a component of what we're doing as therapists. So it's very normal for therapists to stumble upon chronic pain without really having been given any formal training in that area. And so, to be frank, we can inadvertently make things much worse for our clients without intending to. And when I say that, what I mean is there are a lot of treatment modalities out there in the world that are being touted for chronic pain that don't have any evidence base behind them. And so my first suggestion to therapists is go to the literature or go to consult with somebody who does this work. Make sure that whatever it is that you are embarking upon with your client, that it actually is backed in science, because there's a lot of pseudoscience around chronic pain that can make folks' symptoms worse. The other thing that I like to share with therapists who are newer to this world is that anything in extremes is typically not good for our patients with chronic pain. So for example, there's been a lot of research on, I won't get too technical with this, but there's been a lot of research on what's called the cycle of pain and disability. And essentially what it boils down to is that complete rest and full activity can both have really detrimental effects for people with chronic pain. And, you know, very well-meaning therapists, without knowing better, can work with a person who has chronic pain and say, oh, well, if you're in pain, you should take it easy, right? If you're in pain, you should take the day off. If you're in pain, don't do that thing that like makes it worse. This is where kind of going to the literature and collaborating with a medical provider can really help a therapist understand that each person kind of needs to find the in-between in order to promote functioning with chronic pain.
Do you have other examples of like pseudo-scientific, non-effective treatments that your clients have came in saying, somebody suggested this, or I tried this thing and it made it worse?
Yeah. And, you know, I hesitate to throw any particular discipline or modality under the bus because, you know, the reality is research has to start somewhere. And maybe some of these things one day will be proven to be effective and we just don't know it yet. But I am wary of any treatment that doesn't have sort of a progress report that comes along with it, right? There is a lot of misinformation out there, for example, about neurofeedback for chronic pain. And again, the evidence base is a baby one, right? It's not that it doesn't exist, it's that we're not quite sure what we should be doing with neurofeedback to help with chronic pain. We're getting there, but we're not there yet. And so I'm always wary when a client comes in and says, oh, well, I'm doing this thing. And I say, is it helping you to feel better? And they say, well, no, but the provider tells me I just need to keep doing it. That's a red flag for me. If a person cannot identify progress after a period of time in treatment, and or they're telling you the information that they're getting suggests that they just need to do it indefinitely, that's a red flag for me. So again, I go back to the evidence base, right? When we're talking about chronic pain, there's huge support in the literature for sleep, for nutrition, for hydration, for exercise. Every single one of those things has a huge body of research surrounding chronic pain and the efficacy for managing chronic pain. The first line treatments for chronic pain are behavioral and lifestyle interventions. Like that is what the research tells us we need to be doing to manage this stuff. And so I'm always asking about nutrition, hydration, exercise, and sleep in every single one of my assessments, no matter who's coming through the door, because I understand like the biological implications. If those things are not straight, we're not going to have optimum functioning no matter what we do. No matter how many medications somebody's throwing at it, it's not going to get better. So I'm always asking about those things. And if a person says, well, you know, I exercise every day and I've done that for years and it's not helping, that might not be the first place that I start. I might start with sleep instead, right? I'm looking at what are the lifestyle pieces known to impact chronic pain and where can we gain the most traction looking at those things. I will tell you sort of anecdotally, just from experience, I rarely start treatment for chronic pain with mood, mostly because folks don't want to hear that chronic pain and mood are related, right? And it's also a very difficult topic to just dive into in terms of like how this huge change to your identity has impacted your mood. We're here for pain. We want to talk about pain. I usually start with that. And in the process, we look more toward mood, anxiety, and those broader contributions. I would say, like, remember who we are, right? As a profession, we are immensely skilled at meeting people where they're at. And this population in particular is one that has probably experienced a lack of compassion in most areas of their lives. And if we are meeting folks where they are with compassion, we are almost always going to be able to find a way to support them within the evidence base, right? We are good at rephrasing things. We are good at sort of matching an intervention with a client's openness to that intervention or not. This is what we do. And just because it's around chronic pain doesn't mean that we can't be just as effective in aligning with our clients as we can with any other treatment concern. Like, that is the core of who we are as therapists, you know, draw on that, be confident in that. That being said, and, you know, I have trained many, many interns and postdoctoral fellows in psychology. And one thing that I make sure that we never forget is the body of literature on readiness for change, right? And if a person does not want what we have to offer, it is absolutely okay for them to say, I'm not interested in what you have to offer. And for us to say, totally understand, this is a hard journey. If this doesn't feel like a match right now, let me give you some information and some resources that you might want to look at a later point in time. Here's my contact information. Please let me know if I can ever help, right? That is the most humane thing that we can do. Which actually kind of leads me to something really important, if you will indulge me for a second, particularly with the adolescent and young adult population. Personally, I have a very hard line. I will not see adolescents or young adults with chronic pain because somebody else is making them come to therapy. I won't do it. And I'll tell you why. These young people have already had enough experiences of people telling them what to do and it not working. If a young person is not bought into treatment and I continue to try to treat them, number one, they're not going to get better because they're not ready. And number two, the next time that somebody mentions going to therapy, they're going to look at that person and say, I went to therapy and it didn't help, right? So in that way, I've become part of the problem. So readiness for change is huge. We can bring our skills to the table and our clients can bring their readiness to the table. If either one of those things are missing, it's not therapy. There are times when different medical providers will say to adult patients, I'm not going to continue to prescribe pain medication unless you are also participating in therapy to support, you know, your overall functioning. And in that case, the incentive can be, like, let's not have attributions here. The incentive can be improvement, but there can sometimes be this element of, I'm here because my doctor won't help me if I don't come. And that doesn't mean that progress can't be made. It means there's another layer to kind of work through, and a little bit more of a burden on the therapist to sort of gently explore ways that therapy can be helpful, even in the context of it not being the primary motivation.
Are there other foundational things you tell your, you know, interns or others that you're training in this area that you get a lot of like light bulbs kind of go off in their head?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think one big one is sort of the definition of chronic pain itself, right? When we're talking about chronic pain, we are talking about a pain condition that a person has been experiencing for at least 3 months or more. We are not talking about recovery from surgeries. We are not talking about acute injuries that, you know, are still causing pain 2 months later. We are talking about a condition that sticks. And so when we understand the difference between acute pain and chronic pain, we have a better idea of what to do about it, right? If it's acute pain, that needs an acute medical intervention. If it's chronic pain, we're talking about adjustments made over time to support improvement. So that's one thing, just really understanding the difference, because you cannot treat acute pain with chronic pain approaches. It doesn't work. So we want to be sure we're differentiating those two things. The other thing that I think is really helpful for providers to understand is kind of I'll keep it brief, the physiological process of chronic pain, because what has happened for an individual with chronic pain is essentially their body has been hurting for so long that their brains and their autonomic systems have become hypersensitized to the perception of pain. It does not mean that they're faking. It does not mean that they are exaggerating. They are having very real experiences of very painful stimuli, right? But what we know that happens in the brain is that the longer a person experiences that, the more attention the brain is paying to those pain signals. And then before you know it, every physiological sensation, the brain may be interpreting that as an emergency. And so you can imagine sort of the heightened level of experiences that people with chronic pain are having because their body is all the time on high alert. And when we understand that, it gives us a better window of understanding into why things like cognitive behavioral therapy are helpful, why things like grounding, mindfulness, relaxation, biofeedback can help a person with chronic pain, because all of those things help with that overactive arousal system.
Are there other misconceptions that you think therapists or even just the general public has around chronic pain?
I would say, like, number one, sort of the easy answer here is drug-seeking behavior. Just because a person is going to doctor after doctor after doctor after doctor does not make them someone who is seeking drugs or opiates or something. Like, people in pain are desperate, and they are going to look anywhere and everywhere for help. So we really have to watch our assumptions about people's motivations, right? We have to be careful to understand that nobody wants to be in pain. Nobody wants to miss work. Nobody wants to be separated from their family and friends. Nobody wants to be up all night because their body hurts. There is absolutely no reason for a person with chronic pain to behave in any way that would perpetuate that pain, right? People with pain want to be helped, and that's why they're showing up in the spaces they're showing up in. And so I think sort of that unconditional positive regard that we learned day one of grad school, start there. Start with compassion. So I think that's one major misconception. I think another major misconception that comes in is sort of characterizing pain in kind of a black and white way, of like it's either all medical or it's all psychological, because I've never ever in my career seen a case where it isn't at least partly both. Because again, once that pain alarm system kicks off in the brain, then we're dealing with autonomic arousal, and it becomes a detrimental cycle. And so, like, if we're thinking about pain as one or the other, we're not thinking about pain appropriately.
Along with cognitive behavioral therapy, there are other approaches that are common use in the treatment of chronic pain, including acceptance and commitment therapy, mindfulness-based stress reduction, and then expressive therapies, using things like art and music. Support groups can also help. Chronic pain can be isolating. It can feel like no one else understands. So connecting with others who do, it can be big. In one of my conversations with a person living with chronic pain, they said, it just feels like nonstop assumptions that are always accusatory and judgmental, which is just another layer to it. People look at me like I'm to blame for my pain. When is that helpful? In what world would I want this?